From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, tests turn up another PFAS source, this time Selfridge Air National Guard Base.
They found PFAS pouring out of that stormwater system into the Clinton River and Lake St. Clair.
President Trump tweets tariffs are the greatest. A Michigan soybean farmer begs to differ.
Well, I don't think it's great for soybean farmers in America or in Michigan.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Gretchen Whitmer.
I'm beholden to the people of our state, not to a campaign donor, not to a political party.
And Theater Talk looks at a play written in 1677 by a woman.
Set in Naples, it features three pretty randy women, some swashbuckling men, and great humor, and even some very cool swordplay.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state keeps looking for PFAS in our water and keeps finding it. Today brings word of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances pouring into Lake St. Clair. MLive's Garrett Allison used the Freedom of Information Act to get results of MDEQ tests done last winter. He is with us now via Skype. So Garrett, where did they test and what did they find?
Well, the DEQ tested the stormwater outfalls at Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Mount Clemens, and they found PFAS pouring out of that stormwater system into the Clinton River and Lake St. Clair at pretty high levels.
So, yeah, when you use that word pouring, we aren't talking about a trickle. We're not talking about a slight amount.
No, total PFAS. So they tested for six different PFAS compounds. And the sum total of those at one of the drains was 5,000 parts per trillion. And that's going right into the Clinton River and right out into Lake St. Clair, which, by the way, is the drinking water source for several municipalities in the area, some of which are reporting low levels of PFAS detection in their water.
Okay, so what are these communities? And you're saying they're reporting low levels?
The city of Mount Clemens, New Baltimore, and Ira Township, they found low levels in the 1 to 3 parts per trillion range, you know, in their drinking water samples. So that's pretty low, but at the same time, it's one of those things where most people don't want any of this stuff in the drinking water.
And as you say, contamination has been pouring out of a Selfridge Air National Guard Base. Is that ongoing? Is that still happening? Do we know?
I believe it is. The base says that they're considering putting some sort of filtration system on the stormwater drains, but I don't believe that has happened yet.
So can we tell from these results whether there are any other sources of PFAS contamination going into Lake St. Clair besides Selfridge?
Well, the state found a hit in the Clinton River upstream of Selfridge. So there is some indication that Selfridge may not be the only source of PFAS in the lake, which also gets water from the St. Clair River and Lake Huron. That water's got to come through a corridor, which is pretty heavily industrialized. And then we know that there are drinking water systems pulling directly from Lake Huron to the north in the Tawas-Augray area, south of Oscoda, which have been getting low levels of this stuff as well. So can we say that the PFAS in the municipal systems is absolutely from Selfridge? No. But we do know now that Selfridge is a known source of this stuff in Lake St. Clair.
And you've done some digging just to kind of see what has happened at Selfridge in terms of airplane crashes and fire training, right, which leads to the firefighting foam that is the big source of concern.
Right. Selfridge, just like hundreds of military bases, it's not just a problem in Michigan. It's nationwide, even global. They're finding this stuff in Okinawa as well. Selfridge has used the AFFF firefighting foam. It still uses it. It's been used significantly in the past. It's still in use, although the military says they replaced older versions of it, which would have different PFAS chemistry, with newer versions, which would supposed to have less environmentally persistent PFAS chemistries. But what we're seeing is early indications that the base has got a pretty serious PFAS contamination problem.
And what have you gotten in terms of reaction from base officials, but I'm also thinking of city and county water officials?
Well, I was unsuccessful in getting a hold of city water officials in the area. I tried calling Candace Miller's office, the Macomb County Drain Commissioner, and declined to comment on this story. I tried to interview environmental managers with the base, folks who were directly involved in the site investigation. And instead of granting my request for interviews, they essentially developed a press release and sent out that press release a couple of days ago, essentially announcing the existence of this data that had been collected in February.
A preemptive strike, so to speak, get that out before your story.
Well, they didn't release it to everybody. They sent it directly to me and said that they would release it once they got three or more inquiries. So I'm sure they'll probably be released soon.
Garrett, I think you phrased it to me that looking for PFAS in Michigan is like unpeeling an onion. Is it really coming true that the more you look, the more you're finding?
Yeah, and that is pretty much the way it's been going for the state. They're looking in all kinds of different places. They're looking at old landfills. They're looking for wherever this AFFF foam was used. They're looking in wastewater plants, having the wastewater plants ask industrial users that send effluent to those plants whether they use this stuff. And just the more data that's collected, the better picture that the general public is getting. And the map of Michigan is starting to fill up with dots.
Garrett Ellison of MLive. Thank you so much, Garrett.
Yep, thanks for having me.
President Trump fired yet another salvo in his escalating trade war with China, the EU, and Canada, tweeting earlier today, and I quote, "Tariffs are the greatest. Either a country which has treated the United States unfairly on trade negotiates a fair deal, or it gets hit with tariffs. Remember, we are the piggy bank that's being robbed. All will be great." Midwestern farmers are caught in the crosshairs of this trade war, especially soybean farmers, because China is their biggest customer. Matt Stutzman is a farmer from Adrian. He grows corn, wheat, and soy. He's a board member for the Michigan and American Soybean Associations. And he is with us now from the Lenawee County Fair. Matt, the president says all will be great. How do you view this tit-for-tat trade war?
Well, I don't think it's great for soybean farmers in America or in Michigan. We seem to be on his side most of the time, but maybe not on this trade issue.
And why is that?
Well, there's 96.48 million bushels produced on 2.27 million acres in Michigan, and 13% are processed in Michigan, 87% leave the state. So we have a huge need for export markets, and China is the largest.
And have you felt an impact from these tariffs yet on your farm?
I think all farmers have, in a way, because the market is depressed right now. We've seen drop prices since this trade war has begun, and that definitely affects every farmer in the United States.
And did you plant extra soy this year? Because that's a narrative I'm hearing in discussions about the trade wars all over the country. Did you plant extra soy?
We did last year because the market told us that there was a little more profit to be made with soybeans. Not this year. We went back to our regular rotation.
Okay. Now, what do you hear from other farmers in Michigan? I'm wondering if this trade war and these tariffs will be hitting some farmers harder than others.
That's definitely true. Since I'm a third-generation farmer and I'm fairly young now, I'm looking at, you know, farming for 20, 30 more years possibly, or in it for the long term. But like the younger farmers that are thinking about coming in or just establishing themselves right now, or the farmers that are wanting to retire, anytime you have these low prices, you're talking about just potential to lose money. You don't like to see that, and you're not definitely promoting somebody wanting to join farming right now because they're just not going to make much money doing it, if at all.
Mm. Now, Matt, you say you want the government to either back off the tariffs or get them done quickly. What do you mean by that? Why do you say that?
Well, if they could rescind the tariff, I think things will, you know, business will come back right as usual. If it's short, then and we get a win and everybody wins from this, then we can maybe actually come away from this with improved markets for both countries.
Do you trust what the president's doing?
I'd have to say I don't, but if I knew what he was doing, maybe I would.
Now, we have CNBC is reporting that the Trump administration is readying a $12 billion emergency aid package for farmers affected by tariffs. What kind of aid could most help you and Michigan farmers?
Well, anytime we can develop other foreign markets, that gives us a little more diversified portfolio where we can export our beans. That would be beneficial, but that's more of a long-term kind of an investment. It's not definitely going to fix it right away. What the farm bill does is help subsidize insurance. That kind of can help support farmers. But payments in a form of, you know, just one and done, those tend not to really be that beneficial to farmers, because with subsidizing farmers, other countries will have issue with that, and they can have cases against that kind of thing. That I don't know how they're going to figure out how to support farmers. The best way to do it is just let the market pay us and help those markets, and in doing that would be just to stop trade wars.
Since this began in the spring, Matt, I'm wondering, how are relations between Michigan soybean farmers like you and your Chinese customers?
You know, I think so far, Chinese customers buying beans and U.S. farmers selling beans, we still have a pretty good relationship, as we have in the past, and I think going forward possibly. This is more of a high-level government versus government. There's nothing that they can do, nothing we can really do, other than sort of just tell our constituents that we need this to be short or stopped to help our business expand and continue.
As you think, Matt, of how this tariffs and the tit for tat, how this could play out, in your mind, what's the best case scenario and the worst case scenario?
Yeah, good question. The best case scenario would be to have this war be short. China come out of this saying, okay, we'll play by the rules, you know, and we'd like to buy more beans from you now that the war is over. And the way to fix this deficit would be to actually buy more soy from the U.S. and maybe a little less from Brazil and the other importers to that country. And then the worst case scenario would just be to have this drag out for years, and you know, we have like another 1980s, just real depressed market, and just not hard, very difficult to recover from.
Matt Stutzman is a third-generation farmer from Adrian, and he was with us from the Lenawee County Fair. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Later in the hour, we'll hear what the dispute between the Michigan Civil Rights Commission and Attorney General Bill Schuette means for the LGBTQ community in Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time for Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with his latest look at professional theater companies around the state, beginning with the Michigan Shakespeare Festival.
That's right. We're in full swing now with all three plays in production in Jackson at the Bauman Theater at Jackson College. And they'll move soon to Canton to the Village Theater. And you can come to Encore Michigan or the Michigan Shakespeare site to chart what day or night or and which venue you want to go see. The Tempest, Measure for Measure, and The Rover are all playing this week into the weekend at Jackson. The Tempest, I want to point out, it actually features Janet Haley in the role of Prospera, feminized from Shakespeare's Prospero.
Okay.
Now, before any purists have a problem with this, I got to tell you, Haley is a multiple award winner. She's actually nominated for a non-Shakespeare thing for our Wild Awards this year. She is a brilliant actress. Cannot recommend seeing this production enough.
And Measure for Measure is a comedy and complicated, so things ensue and you need to pick all through that. What about The Rover?
The Rover, really interesting. It's a comedy written in 1677 by a writer named Aphra Behn, probably the first woman to succeed as a professional playwright in England. She had quite a life as a writer, a translator, and even as a spy for Charles II. And last season, Kickshaw Theater here in Ann Arbor performed a play called Orr, which was about her life. The plot of The Rover, it's a little complicated, but it suffices to say, it set in Naples. It features three pretty randy women.
Well, hey.
Some swashbuckling men and great humor and even some very cool swordplay. Also, highly recommended.
Okay. Listen, if you're talking about three randy women, there you go. You just got everybody's attention
And all three plays move to Canton on August 3rd and run there through August 19th.
Such a smart move, so you can really pull in audiences. And now we go to the Tibbetts Opera House in Coldwater.
Yeah, I saw Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder this past weekend. I got to say, it is really terrific. I love this play. I saw it on Broadway as well. It's very funny. It's based on a novel written in the 1930s. It was then made into a 1949 film with Alec Guinness called Kind Hearts and Coronets. It's about the son of a black sheep member of an aristocratic family. And when the young man's mother dies, she reveals this to him, and he finds that there are 8 members of the family ahead of him in the line to the earldom. So he goes about knocking off all 8. Now, the real star of this play is actor Brian Sage, who plays all 8 members of the family to meet their doom. He is in constant costume change. He plays the smoking jacket wearing squire who hates his wife, a society matron, world adventurer. He plays a crazy, very gay beekeeper. He's really a wonder to see.
This is like a 14-course meal for an actor.
It is. And he knocks it out of the park.
Let's take a listen to a little bit from the Broadway cast recording from A Gentleman's Guide.
For those of you of weaker constitution, for those of you who may be faint of heart, this is a tale of revenge and retribution. So if you're smart, before we start, you'd best depart.
I know this was a big hit on Broadway, and it certainly seems that this production has your wholehearted endorsement.
It is. It has a little touch of Gilbert and Sullivan feeling to it. And I also want to say the first two shows of the summer season at the Tibbetts were kind of disappointing, but man, they made it up with this one. Yeah.
All right, and that's the Tibbetts Opera House in Coldwater. And now we swing over to Oakland County to Shakespeare Royal Oak 2018 from the Waterworks Theater Company.
Yeah, they are in the park at the Star JC Park in Royal Oak, and they'll open this week with Much Ado About Nothing. And judging from the play poster and preview, this production, very interesting, is set in World War II.
I'm intrigued.
And yeah, me too. And I have to tell you, I'm very keen to see it because it's always really interesting to me when Shakespeare is moved out of the time in which it was written. I saw a pretty brilliant Richard III in New York that was set in Nazi Germany.
You may have seen it.
And it was made into a movie. So very
Ian McKellen, I believe.
And Annette Bening, too, was in it. So very keen to see this production of Much Ado About Nothing.
July 26th to August 5th. And boy, if the weather holds, what a beautiful evening in the park that could be. Now we head to West Michigan to Saugatuck, where Mason Street Warehouse is doing, and I've got to just say this because if I can get through without laughing, one of the best name shows I've ever heard. Dixie's Never Wear a Tube Top While Riding a Mechanical Bull and 16 Other Things I Learned While I Was Drinking Last Thursday. We're not talking highbrow theater, are we, David?
Yeah, no. Although I will say, if Shakespeare wrote it, I think he would have said whilst riding a mechanical bull.
Oh, I love it.
But this is a one-man, or should I say one-man in drag show. It's set in a roadhouse in Mobile, Alabama, as a hurricane rages outside, and Dixie is cleaning up the place after her friend's bachelorette party the night before. She's doling out a lot of funny advice. Look, I've not seen this play ever. And I have to say, I don't like these kinds of plays, but it's light summer fare, and I must say, artistic director Kurt Stamm, who is the artistic director of Mason Street Warehouse, has an excellent track record for picking the right shows to do. So I have faith that it will be okay.
And I kind of dug around, and when that play has been in other, other areas, other states, it gets good reviews. So I
won't write it off like I've written off some of these other plays. And then finally, there's a few more chances to see Lion King up at the Wharton Center in Lansing. There is a lot to be worried about in the play today, and we could all do a lot worse than to think Hakuna Matata. Or, don't worry, be happy.
And you can get the details of all of these productions. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, many thanks.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and Michiganders played an important part of that hard-fought victory. Thousands of Michigan men fought in France with the 32nd Division, known as the Red Arrow Division, among them the grandfather of writer Richard Backus. Joseph Backus of Ann Arbor and Harbor Springs led his men into the trenches and received a battlefield promotion from General John Pershing. Rich Backus wrote a novel based on his family's experiences during the Great War. Its title, Into No Man's Land. Rich, tell us about your grandfather Joseph and just what he did during World War I.
Well, in World War I, he was already an older guy. He was in his 30s, and so he had quite a bit of military experience. He was in the Navy and the Marine Corps before. And he ended up being a company commander, so he was in charge of about 200 or so men as they went into the trenches in France. And they actually, about 100 years ago today, they were just kind of coming out of their first round of trench duty in Alsace-Lorraine.
And this famous Red Arrow Division, the 32nd, a very storied division, and it was what, basically Michigan and Wisconsin soldiers?
Yes, in World War I, it was Michigan and Wisconsin soldiers. It's kind of gone back and forth, I think, between those two. But now it is, to this day, it's just sort of been reunited again in the past year or so. So that includes both Wisconsin and Michigan National Guards men and women.
So tell us how the kinds of soldiers who came together, on, wearing that patch of the Red Arrow Division, who served along with your grandfather, Joseph.
Well, there were all kinds of folks from, Ann Arbor and Jackson, Kalamazoo, kind of that southwestern part of Michigan is where his company, the main company he was in, was Company E. They came from that area, and they were familiar names, like, there's like hardware store in Ann Arbor. I think it was Schlenker's or something like that. Various folks from all over the state, and a lot of them were not professional soldiers when they went in, and that was one of the reasons why they hated my grandfather at first. He was one, like, the most hated man in the company because he really made them train very hard, and by the time they got to France and got into the trenches and figured out what he was getting them ready for, he was the most beloved man in the company.
There you go. He had them ready for that time in the trenches, which, as best you can be, because we know that really was difficult. Did your grandfather write journals or keep, write letters home that have been preserved? I'm wondering how much of what he went through is preserved in family lore.
So he died before I was born, so I never got any of this stuff firsthand. And really wasn't until about my 20s that I had a distant aunt die, and she gave me the family archive. And being a writer and someone loves history, I kind of dug in there and started finding these amazing stories. And I didn't really start off to write a World War I novel, but it was such a central part to his career, which basically spread from the beginning of the century, early 1900s, all the way past the end of World War II. He ended up as a colonel.
What did those Michigan and Wisconsin soldiers manage to accomplish when they were fighting in the trenches in World War I?
It's kind of interesting because they had a little bit of experience beforehand. They'd all got sent in 1916 down to the Mexican border because of Pancho Villa. Pancho Villa shot things up, and so for about 9 months before World War I broke out, and then when it did, they kind of like went home, and then they basically got mustered again for World War I by the summer of 1917, and then they got sent back to Texas for more training before they went to France. These guys, I would say that their contribution was really significant. Basically, these divisions would be kind of put together on the front, and they might cover, you know, 5 to 10 miles of the front would be a division's, you know, territory. And they started off going to this quiet sector of Alsace-Lorraine, which is down near Switzerland. And actually, they were the first, you know, U.S. boots on German soil, because the French had actually kind of, when the war broke out, they'd sort of gone under the underbelly of Germany while Germany was coming up through Belgium. And so they were in trenches in French on German territory in 100 years ago from today.
And what about rate of casualties? How did they fare?
So their first experience in the trenches, you know, was certainly eye-opening to them, and you know, there's constant danger, but not a whole lot of people were killed right away in that Alsace-Lorraine. I think they lost somewhere in the neighborhood of a dozen men, and that's pretty, you know, good. But later on, they went into some of the most ferocious battles of World War One, you know, including the Second Battle of the Marne, where they got sent next, and their total casualties were about 14,000. So that includes both wounded and killed.
And just to get everybody on the same page, when we talk about a division and we talk about the famous Red Arrow Division, the 32nd, how many would that have been?
So I think a division at that time was about 20,000, somewhere in the neighborhood of that. The modern day equivalents are much smaller. I think there's about 5,000 people total in what's called now a brigade combat team.
Sure. But when we say then 14,000 either killed or wounded out of 20,000, that's a heavy burden.
Yeah, they had a lot of replacements. Just in the one company of that my grandfather was in charge of, they'd had about probably 200 men. And by the end of the war, according to one of his sergeants who did keep a journal, they'd had like 444 casualties. You know, some people obviously were replaced and new people came in, and some of those, you know, older people made it through the whole war unhurt, but the replacements outnumbered the total.
So how is the role of the Red Arrow Brigade being celebrated at this 100th anniversary year?
So in a lot of ways, nationally, the United States World War I Centennial Commission is trying to create a World War I monument in Washington, D.C., and it's just a couple few blocks away from the White House, and there's an existing Pershing Park, and they're trying to make that into a national memorial. There's also, of course, the wonderful National Memorial in Kansas City, where they actually had a huge commemoration last year in April at the beginning of the American entrance into World War One.
How about here in Michigan?
So here in Michigan, we finally got a Michigan World War One Centennial Commission, and people are basically going around and just really trying to re-educate us about World War One, because it really seems to be the forgotten war. You know, we know July 4th, we know that day is in America, we know December 7th, the day of the Living Infamy, but, you know, April 26th, you know, who knows? That's really the beginning of World War One. And we do have November 11th, which is now, you know, Veterans Day, used to be Armistice Day, and that marked the end of the war. So all of their veterans are died now. There are no living veterans anymore. So we're trying to work on preserving, like, memorials, like little towns. There was a really cool project called 100 Cities, 100 Memorials, where they're refurbishing and just kind of redoing any of those World War One memorials in people's towns. And there's still some available kind of matching money for that. And also just really telling the stories. I think that's the most important. And there's some great stories on the U.S. World War One Centennial Commission's website and the Michigan pages within that.
Why is it important for us to remember this war from a century ago?
First of all, I think about, like, the number of people who died in the war is really pretty astounding. It's probably like the third largest war losses that we've had in the United States. It's not too far behind World War II. But you got to realize that World War II, that happened over 4 years. And most of the Americans that were killed in World War I happened within the space of less than a year. So there was a huge sacrifice. And, you know, you go overseas, and as I had, and, you know, I'd be traveling around these little villages, and here in the middle of some little village is this, you know, big monument to, you know, the 32nd Division or the 126th Infantry Regiment or these various American units that served over there and really helped end the war. The biggest impact was that when the United States and the folks from Michigan got in, you know, the Russians the year before had had the revolution, and they kind of went home. They kind of left the war, and so the Germans were able to kind of throw everybody back over on the Western Front, and the Americans and Michigan folks were able to really staunch that spread because they were actually trying. They came within about 50 miles of Paris in the spring of 1918.
And well, the war to end all wars, thinking that that was being done 100 years ago right now, including the Michigan men who served with the Red Arrow Division, the 32nd Division, and Richard Backus's novel based on his grandfather's service in that division in World War I is titled Into No Man's Land. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Cynthia. I appreciate it. And I hope everybody gets a chance to just dig a little deeper into their family histories and see if they can bring out some of those stories about the folks that served in World War I.
We've been checking back in with the 2018 gubernatorial candidates. Up next, Gretchen Whitmer in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's primary election is 2 weeks from today, so we're bringing you a second round of conversation with the candidates for governor. Today, Democratic candidate Gretchen Whitmer. She served in the state legislature from 2001 to 2015, including 4 years as minority leader in Michigan's Senate. Welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I was very struck by something I read, a response you gave to MLive's Emily Lawler when she asked, how would you run Michigan if you were elected governor? And you pointed to Republican William Milliken as your inspiration. Why was that?
Well, you know, I think that right now in an era where we've got so many politicians that are quick to demonize one another, demonize anyone who doesn't see the world the same way, we really have to get back to building bridges here in Michigan. And Bill Milliken was someone who I think had great leadership skills, worked with the legislature, worked right over him when he had to, but was a professional and an optimist and was not beholden to a party, but was beholden to the people of Michigan. And I think that's really important, and that's what I find so appealing about the work that he did as governor.
Now, whether this November brings a blue wave or not, many believe that the state Senate will remain in Republican hands, possibly because of the way the legislative district maps are drawn. If you become governor, tell us, how would you work with a chamber that in all likelihood would try to stop your agenda?
Well, I think that it's crucial that we have got the ability to cross the aisle in order to get things done. When I was in the legislature, I was, you know, an ardent advocate for the real things when my values were on the line. But when I had the ability to cross the aisle, when it was time to put the votes together to expand Medicaid or anti-bullying protections for kids, I really worked very well with the Republicans, and I think that's something that's important. You know, I'm beholden to the people of our state, not to a campaign donor, not to a political party, but to the people of our state. I'm a proud Democrat, but I'm also a woman who is a mom and doesn't accept excuses in my household, and I don't accept them from our government either. We've got to work together to solve problems.
I want to move over to education, particularly something that Detroit Public School Community District Superintendent Nikolai Vitti told us on this program recently. And he pointed out the school buildings in Detroit are in such abysmal shape. He figures it's going to take $500 million to repair them. And if repairs aren't done, that cost is only going to balloon into the billions. But under the terms of the bailout plan approved by the state, the DPSCD can't borrow money, and the state allocated about $25 million for repairs. What kind of solution do you see to that $475 million gap?
Well, sadly, Detroit is not the only district where there are outdated buildings, dangerous conditions.
But most of those other districts can borrow, and Detroit's can't.
That's right. But yet, we still have to have, I think, a statewide plan that includes ensuring that Detroit is on the right footing to have buildings that are, you know, worthy of our children and promote strong learning and reversing the trend that we've seen in education in Michigan. it is on me as governor to write the plan, to work with the legislature to get it done, and the business community and parents and children across the state to make sure that we are building the schools that are worthy of our kids. And the Detroit Public Schools deserve a governor who's going to work with Dr. Vitti, with Mayor Duggan, with the business community and, you know, parents alike to make sure that we're meeting our kids' needs. And I'm determined to do that. We've been failing generations of kids in Michigan in education. We used to lead the world, and now we're in the bottom 10 in our country, and we're failing our children, and that's why education is the backbone of all of the platform that I've been running on and the work that I'm determined to accomplish as governor.
And how would a Whitmer administration deal with the struggling, low-performing schools, the ones with the bad test scores? I mean, we've seen that list of schools in danger of being closed. What would you do differently?
Well, I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't threaten to close down schools that don't meet our expectations. I would wrap them around with the supports they need so they can be successful. States that have turned around struggling districts are states that have made a greater investment, whether it is in our teachers and our parapros and the dedicated public servants who go into education, all the way to the foundation allowance for kids in high poverty districts, a weighted foundation allowance, but also ensuring that our young people have the wraparound services that they need. The philosophy in Lansing right now out of the Republicans is that if you're not reading by the end of third grade, you get punished by being held back. All the research in the world shows that's the worst thing that you can do for that student and that student's family. What we should be doing is having a no-excuses philosophy that we're going to wrap our students around. We're going to make sure every student is successful, not punishing when our system fails to meet their needs.
Lack of public transportation is one of the reasons Michigan lost its shot at the Amazon second headquarters. Although last week we see the opposition of Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson and Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle killing any chance of letting voters this November decide the fate of the Regional Transit Authority, the RTA. How would you as governor lead in efforts to improve public transportation, not only Southeast Michigan, but throughout the state?
Well, I support the RTA. I voted in favor of, you know, letting the region move forward on it when we had the chance to vote on it in the legislature. It's something that is absolutely critical. You're right. When Amazon declined to keep Michigan in the top 20, they cited talent and they cited transit. You know, everyone, in order to get ahead, needs a good job, but you've got to be able to get to that job. And our lack of transit is hurting us, you know, in competition with the rest of the world, but it's hurting our ability for families to take care of themselves. And so I believe that once I fix the damn roads, that people like Mark Hackle can perhaps find their way to embracing a regional transit, because I know employers, whether they're in Macomb County or Oakland County or Wayne County, are relying on the workforce to get reliably, predictably to their jobs, and that this is something that is a great economic benefit for not just the families and the workforce that relies on it, but for the businesses who need that skilled workforce to get to work.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Democratic candidate Gretchen Whitmer, who is running for governor. Center for Public Integrity in 2015 ranked Michigan dead last in government accountability and transparency. And part of that F grade was based on the fact Michigan's governor and legislators are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. What's your position?
I've always supported opening up the executive office and the legislative branch to FOIA, to the Open Meetings Act, to putting everything online so in an easily searchable way so that the press and the public can find out what the heck is going on with government. And that's something I remain committed to.
And on that subject of transparency, late yesterday, the group Build a Better Michigan, which is the nonprofit 527 group supporting you, released the report it had sent to the IRS revealing donors to the advertising campaign, $1.8 million. And it showed your father is one of the only Blue Cross Blue Shield affiliated donors to donate. And your donors are liberal groups and unions, nothing unusual. But your rivals have had months to press their narratives that you're accepting donations from corporations who want to maintain the status quo, particularly Blue Cross Blue Shield. Could your campaign, do you think, have done anything differently or earlier to counter that criticism?
You know, I have been running the only grassroots campaign of anyone running for governor. 84% of the people that have contributed to me reside within our state. 83% have contributed $100 or less. No one else on either side of the ballot can boast that fact. And that's what a real grassroots movement looks like. We collected petition signatures through Volunteer Army in all 83 counties. I'm really proud of the campaign that we run. This Build a Better Michigan is an outside organization. I'm glad that they released the information. I know that they've been doing everything by the book, and I am committed to doing that.
And is the campaign, the list of donors, is that coming out on the 27th, I believe, they're due? Is that coming out?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. What do you think Democrats can do to win back Trump voters?
Well, you know, I've gotten around the state, and whether you are in rural Michigan or you are in urban Michigan, you're up north or you're in southeast Michigan, people are worried about the dinner table issues. They want to know that they have a way to get into a high-wage job, that when you turn on the water, it's going to be safe for your family to drink, that your schools are supporting your kids and putting them in a position to be successful in life, and yes, that they can travel the roads and get to their destination safely. These are the dinner table issues for people of all walks. And I know as I talked to a gentleman earlier today, he's a Trump voter. He's not happy with his options on the Republican side. And so he was interested in speaking with me. And he said, I like the fact that you want to fix the roads. You know, I think we find our common ground around those dinner table issues. And that's what I'm focused on fixing for people in this state.
Now, you have not yet announced a running mate, but you and your team, I'm sure, are looking at possibilities. Anything you might be able to share with us?
Nope. I've not made a decision yet. And I've got to win the primary first. And that's what I'm focused on.
What can you tell us about what you're looking for in your running mate?
Well, you know, I think that the worst case scenario where I don't survive the term, I want to know that there's someone who can step up and lead and be a good governor. And in the interim, hopefully that never happens, but I need a partner who is going to help me fix the problems that Michiganders are facing.
And if you do not win the nomination August 7th, do you have any reservations about endorsing whoever does win?
I'm a Democrat, and I think that the prospect of a Bill Schuette governor would set us back, incredibly far back as a state. And so I am going to support the Democratic nominee.
Gretchen Whitmer, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
As part of our series of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates, we invited Democrat Sri Tanadar to join us as well. Tanadar, however, did not respond to our request for an interview. There's a big tug of war going on between the Michigan Civil Rights Commission and State Attorney General Bill Schuette, and in the middle, Michigan's LGBTQ citizens. You may recall in May, the Civil Rights Commission decided to include LGBTQ individuals as people protected by the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. That prompted a response last Friday from the AG and a counterpunch Monday from the commission. With us now is Stephanie White, Executive Director of Equality Michigan. Stephanie, take us back to just what the Civil Rights Commission declared in May and why.
So in May, the Civil Rights Commission voted on a request for an interpretive statement that Equality Michigan actually made last year. Last year, coming together with all of the LGBT community and organizations in our state, we submitted a request to the Civil Rights Commission that they follow the path that federal courts have been traveling, which is to recognize that this kind of discrimination, which we had previously seen as distinct, that we called sexual orientation, gender identity, is actually just variations on sex discrimination. So in their role as a commission who's tasked with interpreting civil rights laws, we asked them to issue an interpretive statement to recognize that, yes, sex discrimination does cover the LGBT community.
So that came out in May, and they said, yes, it does.
Yes, it does. They agree.
All right. And then last Friday, the Attorney General issued an opinion which said—
Well, the Attorney General, after being requested by some of the Republican leadership in our state, the Attorney General did not volunteer this, but rather he was requested. He issued a statement that said, In fact, the Civil Rights Commission overstepped their rules. He believes that they went too far, that they don't have the authority to make that interpretation, that they violated the plain meaning of the law, and that their interpretation is invalid.
And that the sex part of the sex discrimination part of the Elliott Larson Act is male, female, not the sexual orientation issue.
Right. He believes that if lawmakers wanted sexual orientation, yes, gender identity to be covered, they would have done it in the past.
All right. Now take us to Monday and this counterpunch from the Michigan Civil Rights Commission.
Well, they met Monday. After much counsel and research, they recognized that, no, we are an independent commission. The Constitution of the state of Michigan has tasked us. Not only do they have the right, but they have the responsibility to interpret these civil rights laws.
So they're going to stay the course.
They're staying the course.
So is Attorney General Schuette's opinion legally binding?
Well, you know, finally, we'll have to probably go to court and you'll find out. But I think it's very clear from previous Michigan State Supreme Court rulings that, in fact, it is not binding on this commission. That very clearly this issue has come up in the past and the Michigan State Supreme Court has said no. The Attorney General's opinion is not binding on the action of an independent commission such as this one.
You know, Mr. Schuette's suggestion was if you want to change the law, you either go through the legislature or you do a ballot proposal.
This is not a change to the law. I agree with him, but we are not changing the law. The Civil Rights Commission did not change the law.
So what impact will all of this, do you think, have on investigations and complaints that have been filed by LGBT people, under the Elliott Larson Act?
Well, it's wonderful. It gives people an actual chance or actual path towards justice. So right now, there are about 43 different cities and municipalities around the state of Michigan that have local non-discrimination ordinances. But as you know, local cities have limited cash, limited resources.
They do not have deep pockets.
They do not have deep pockets. And those local ordinances as well only cover about 2.5 million people in our state out of 9 million. So it leaves a lot of people uncovered. It also leaves a lot of companies and businesses unaware, kind of, and uncertain of what their roles and responsibilities are. So the impact is multiple fold. One is that individuals will be able to have their cases heard and taken seriously, that they will be, you know, treated equally under the law, which is what LGBT people want. Mm-hmm. Number two, businesses will have a clear understanding of their responsibilities under the law to treat customers equally.
But don't you think people are going to hear what Mr. Schuette said Friday? Okay, and then what?
And then, you know, if they run crosswise of the law, then the Civil Rights Commission will correct their misperception.
You see this going to court ultimately.
I think it's very likely, and which is fine. I mean, I think one of the confusions that Attorney General Schuette has been trying to sow is that he somehow has the ultimate say on the interpretation, and that is not true. Our Constitution clearly states that the commission's actions take precedent unless and until a court overrules them, a court. Attorney General Schuette is not a court.
So you're saying bring it on.
Well, I think we're in good – I mean, I would be happy if the law stayed the way it is because it is fair and it is grounded in precedent, both federal precedent, national practice of civil rights law, as well as in our courts' previous decisions. So I don't need it to go to court, but if it does, this Civil Rights Commission is in very firm footing.
Stephanie White, Executive Director of Equality Michigan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Like so many other states, Michigan is kind of at a crossroads when it comes to marijuana policy. Of course, the drug is still illegal at the federal level, but public opinion is shifting. More than 60% of Americans now favor legalizing weed. And of course, this November, Michiganders will vote on whether to allow recreational marijuana use. What does all this mean for our state's economy, healthcare, or criminal justice system? Help us figure it out. Submit your questions about the future of marijuana in Michigan at michiganradio.org. Just look for the stateside question box on the right side of the page. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, Gabby Horton, and Sophie Sherry. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.